Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, the incredible human journey, how our ancestors originated and then emerged from Africa, and how we're all probably the descendants of a very small but fearless bunch of people. Dr. Alice Roberts gives us the story. Swine flu and what you should do about it. We give you the no-nonsense, hype-free guide.
It's a big flashing warning light, basically. When there's a huge decline in butterflies, we know there's more problems to come.
Producer Scott hangs out with some butterflies at the Natural History Museum and finds out why these beautiful creatures are slowly disappearing. All that, plus a gene for autism, a status report on the health of the planet, and some rescale pictures in space. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello everyone and welcome to the show, recorded live in our germ-free multimedia studios in London. No panellists this week, but to make up for all of that, we have a special guest. Alice Roberts is a doctor and a TV presenter. She's fronted acclaimed programmes Coast and Don't Die Young. She also lectures in anatomy at Bristol University. Her latest show is an adventure, The Incredible Human Journey, in which Alice tracks down our human ancestors and how they colonised the globe. Alice, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, you started that programme with, as you say, looking at some of the remotest parts of Africa. Take us to where you began.
I was so incredibly excited to travel to some of the places across this series, and probably the most exciting place was the Omo River Valley. This is the place where Richard Leakey found ancient fossils of modern humans, of Homo sapiens, of our species, that have actually fairly recently been redated and have been proven to be the oldest fossils we have of our species. They date to nearly 200,000 years ago. And I was very lucky to be able to go and actually find the place, see the place where those fossils were found.
What is there? Is it forest? Is it rivers? What's there?
I was quite surprised when I was flying over the countryside of Ethiopia. Actually, we flew south from Addis Ababa, and I was really taken aback at how green it was. It almost looked like England on a spring day. You know, it was incredibly green. As you fly over the mountains, there's lots of coffee growing. But then as you get into the south, it becomes a lot more arid. Along the banks of the river, there is a lot of greenery. But as you get out onto the plains, it becomes very dusty, very arid, very difficult place to live, difficult place to grow crops and that sort of thing. So we eventually made our way through this quite arid landscape and into a very, very strange area with weird hills. It's called the Kibish Formation. And it's quite a sort of, I don't know, it looks like a lunar landscape. Very, very bizarre. These massive hills all sort of carved out by the flooding of the river each year.
And so this is the area where the human civilization, well, humans started. Is that the sort of received wisdom?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really received wisdom. It's this is science at its best. This is fossil hunting.
By received wisdom, I meant science. In this show, that's how wisdom happens.
Excellent. Well, what's interesting is that in the program we sort of show how science is a very dynamic subject and it changes, and it's only very recently, in fact, that the dating of those fossils has proven to be quite that old. So new dating techniques have been applied to evidence that was found 30 odd years ago. But yes, I mean, it looks like from both the fossil evidence and the genetic evidence that our ancestors originated in Africa. And I mean, absolutely everybody's ancestors, and probably around 200,000 years ago.
So 200,000 years ago, there was small bands of people living in this area that you went to. What happened next? Was it that one of the bands decided that this wasn't enough for them and they had to somehow move away?
What we're looking at is a very successful species, which is spreading out. It's doing what any species does when the population expands. It spreads out over a larger and a larger and a larger area.
The contention of the programme as well, and from the evidence that we have, is that a very small group did actually leave Africa, and they are the ones who essentially colonised the entire rest of the world. It sounds like quite an incredible claim, but so take us through the evidence for that.
What's interesting about this is you've got very ancient evidence emerging out of the ground, but at the same time you can actually get some evidence from looking at everybody that's alive today and analysing their genetics, analysing their genes. You can look at the genes that are in the nucleus, in the chromosomes, but they get jumbled up at each generation, and they can make constructing a family tree a little bit complicated. It's better to look at the genes inside the mitochondria, which are these little, they're like the power stations of the cell, really. They're tiny little packages inside the cell, which each contain a little bit of DNA. Now, that doesn't get mixed up at each generation. So it's much easier to trace the family tree backwards through time.
This band, they left and they went obviously into what we call the Middle East now and beyond. And this then explains the incredible variation that you see in the phenotype of people all around the world. So the Africans when they left Africa would have looked like, I suppose, like most Africans look today. Whereas now you get everyone from blonde hair, blue eyes to Native American Indians and all sorts of things.
I think sometimes skin colour sort of gets in the way of us seeing the real variation. People in Africa are incredibly diverse in the way they look. I mean, if you think about somebody, for instance, who comes from Egypt, and then think about somebody who comes from sub-Saharan Africa, they look completely different. And in fact, Africa is more diverse than the rest of the world in terms of both phenotypes, but also genotypes as well. Most of the genetic diversity of the human species exists in Africa. That is a very powerful reason for believing that that's where our species originated. But yes, this small group of people seems to have got out of Africa. The geneticists estimate that this was literally a few hundred people, which is something which is quite mind-blowing. And that those people, those few hundred people, were then the ancestors of everybody who is of non-African descent.
The series is five programmes long. And the first programme, as you say, most of it is concerned with Africa and finding these areas that the migration started from. But where else do you go? Where is it that you sort of are the most interesting places, if you like?
The second programme is looking at Siberia and China. And I was really pleased to be able to go and visit Shakutien, which is a place where some very ancient fossils of Homo erectus, so a species much earlier than us, was found and has been called Peking Man. The third programme is Europe, absolutely wonderful. There's also a programme about the this arc of human migration along the coast of the Indian Ocean and eventually to Australia, which was always separate from the mainland. So they must have had some kind of boat. And we test that out kind of by building a bamboo raft and paddling between two islands in Indonesia just to see if it's possible. And it was. It was a bit scary, though.
I don't know. Getting yourself into the mindsets of people who must have done that at some point. Someone must have done it. Sailing off to the horizon when you have no idea what's the end of it. An incredibly successful species based on bravery and perhaps a bit of foolhardiness.
Amongst those people, there probably were some quite heroic, brave people who struck out and decided to go and look at a new island or a new bit of land. But also, there probably would have been people in sort of crude boats fishing along the shores and getting pulled by currents and almost colonising new places by chance. I think that, you know, the chance would have played quite a large part in this as well. And a lot of the time, rather than a sort of heroic quest to colonise new lands, it was probably a lot of just, you know, one sort of portion of a tribe breaking away from the rest of the tribe and going and settling in the next valley. You know, that's what we're talking about, is really a sort of gradual spreading out.
Still quite impressive stuff.
Yeah.
Alice, we'll come back to you later on the programme. Thank you for now, though. Alice's programme, The Incredible Human Journey, starts on BBC Two this Sunday. That's the 10th of May. Now, here's this week's top science stories in the News Jam with me and James Randerson.
News Jam.
Extensive climate change is now affecting every form of life in the Arctic, according to a major new assessment by international polar scientists. In the past 4 years, air temperatures have increased, sea ice has declined sharply, surface waters in the Arctic Ocean have warmed, and permafrost is in some areas rapidly thawing. The Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Programme's study says new factors such as black carbon or soot, ozone and methane may now be contributing to global and Arctic warming as much as carbon dioxide.
Hospital wards are to get a makeover to reduce the spread of lethal superbugs such as MRSA and C. difficile. Furniture and fittings, including chairs, curtains, bedside cabinets and commodes, have been redesigned to eliminate any nooks and crannies where bacteria can lurk. More than 70 British designers have given the hospital ward a much-needed revamp and in the process thrown out the old clunky equipment for new prototypes that are much easier to clean.
Scientists have found the first substantial evidence that autism may be caused by genetic differences that damage connections in the brain in early childhood. Three studies have identified genetic variations which may help explain the origins of the condition, including one that could account for as many as 15% of autism cases. The researchers believe the findings could help the process of identifying people with an autistic spectrum disorder, improve medical treatments, and potentially lead to diagnostic tests for the condition.
And finally, a prank illustration in the Apollo 16 rover manual, which contained a hand-drawn cartoon of an astronaut embracing a buxom naked woman, is on display at the Bonhams Auctioneers, along with around 400 rare and historic items. The prank illustration, added by mischievous support crew back on Earth, followed a tradition of sneaking Snoopy cartoons and other joke pictures into the astronauts' checklists. The cuff-mounted checklist, worn by Charles Duke on the surface of the moon, has an estimated value of £200,000 to £300,000. James, let's talk through a couple of those in brief. The autism story is interesting. The fact that we've been doing more and more research into autism, does this one now mean that we can predict autism?
No, it doesn't. It's an interesting collection of studies. I mean, it sort of builds on what we knew already, that there is a genetic component to autism, but it's very complicated because that genetic component, those genes that are involved, also interact with the environment, and it's through that interaction that autism develops. So, I mean, there's progress here because they've identified individual genes and shown that they have a partial influence on the condition. But, I mean, they're a long way from understanding how those genes cause the condition, how they interact with, how the different versions of the genes, the genetic defects, interact with the environment, and, a very long way from anything approaching a cure, certainly.
There's quite an interesting analogy made by one of the scientists involved, wasn't there, about how this, comparing this discovery and autism with the discoveries of the first genes and how cancer works.
Yes, he made that comparison. And, yeah, just because you understand that certain genes are involved, you don't necessarily know how they're involved or where that information takes you. I mean, potentially you can start then screening for those genetic changes and trying to then predict who may be susceptible to autism or that sort of thing. And that was something that Simon Baron Cohen, the autism researcher at Cambridge, brought up a few months ago as a possibility and something that as a society we need to think about. Actually, this whole topic is very close to me at the moment because my daughter has contracted measles and she is 11 months old, so she's pre-MMR, and the reason that she's contracted measles is my area is full of people who are scared of taking the MMR vaccine.
It's quite brave of you to admit these things private things.
I'm absolutely livid about it. I'm absolutely furious
I'm on your side, and this is another reason to burn down the Daily Mail. Okay, moving on to climate now. The report by the Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Programme sets out some slightly depressing things. James, take us through a couple of the highlights of what's been affected. There's some quite interesting numbers in there.
Yes, I mean, they're sort of pulling together lots of studies that have looked into things like permafrost and sea ice and all the rest of it. For example, they're saying that the summer sea ice in the Arctic in 2007 was 23% less than the previous record low of 5.6 million square kilometres in 2005. In Greenland, the area of the ice sheet that was experiencing melt in 2007 was 60% greater than in 1998. I mean, it was really adding to the sort of picture that's very familiar. Actually, Al Gore was at this meeting and made a big pitch that black carbon or soot is a big part of the problem, that we chuck this stuff up into the atmosphere, it winds up either landing on the ice or the snow up north, or is in the atmosphere, and because it's black, it attracts heat and leads to more melting. So that's a slightly different twist on the sort of global warming story.
That's right. But also, I mean, things like black carbon and things like pollution have actually been keeping the Earth a little bit cooler than it should be, given that they reflect away some of the sunlight or stop it from reaching the surface of the Earth as well. I mean, this is one of the geoengineering techniques, is to put sulfur dioxide or something up in the atmosphere to seed clouds or to essentially block away the sunlight. I think that this kind of study shows, actually, that you can't predict all of the consequences of this stuff at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole global dimming story is slightly complex. That obviously in some scenarios black carbon is a problem, in others you can imagine, well, I mean, it has been the case that particulates in the atmosphere have actually radiated heat back out, or have bounced heat back out into the into space, and so kept the warming down. And now that we've begun to start cleaning up, well, since we began starting to clean up our our industries, and meaning that there's fewer particulates going into the atmosphere, the rate of warming has increased.
Well, just one other thing, just slightly worrying. I suppose we know this already. John Vidal, our environment editor, was up in the Arctic looking at the sort of CO2 monitoring stations up there. And the sort of official figure for the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at the moment is about 382 parts per million. The Arctic was measuring significantly higher than that this last week.
Yeah, 397.
So we're already getting up to the magic 400 number. Are we doomed? Let's leave on that.
Probably. I mean,
No.
The difficulty is that with that particular number, though, that there are various reasons why you would expect the number in the Arctic to be higher than the average. Don't get too worried about the 397 figure, but it's still higher than
Let's wait for the official NASA numbers that come out once a year from Hawaii. Okay, James, thanks very much. For more information on any of those stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
You'll notice we haven't mentioned swine flu in the news jam. Well, we thought that given the acres of alarming coverage across the globe, we might step back and look at what we really should and shouldn't be worried about. So I spoke to Adam Cameron Scott from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's part of the international team that tracks diseases as they spread around the world. I started by asking him to tell me what, if anything, made the current swine flu virus dangerous.
Would appear to be a new strain of influenza, which we haven't seen for quite some time and to which people have little or no immunity to. So there is the threat that while people who contract influenza year upon year may develop a bit of a level of an immunity to it, this new strain, the fact that it is a new strain, means that people around the world have got little or no immunity to it. So it's a virus which has got pandemic potential.
How does a potential pandemic like this start? What happens to make something like this start?
Influenza viruses in particular are quite unstable in that they go through multiple mutations every time they replicate. So every now and then you end up with a new virus that emerges which has gone through this mutation to which people have no immunity to.
Okay, so once it's there, once this potential dangerous virus is around, and it looks like it might start to cross borders and affect lots of people and be transferred amongst people.
Right.
Which institutions spring into action to sort of try and stem this, stem the problems?
Well, certainly the World Health Organization is one of the key institutions in the global fight against infectious diseases of this sort of nature. And they've got a number of mechanisms in place, not only search engines to try and pick up media reports about potential new outbreaks, but also a global network of scientists and laboratories that work together to try and identify influenza viruses of this sort of nature.
And so the World Health Organization coordinates the global response. Are they responsible for making sure that vaccines start to get produced, for distributing samples to different places?
Well, they certainly work in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies through the Global Influenza Surveillance Network. And the laboratories, basically each year, virus samples are sent to these laboratories. The laboratories sort of break them down, look at them to see what sort of how they're constructed and which vaccines would be the best. And the World Health Organization then liaises with pharmaceutical companies to try and develop a vaccine both for the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere, because obviously the flu seasons for both of those hemispheres are different. And so the virus strains circulating in those two hemispheres can also be different.
How long will it take to produce a vaccine or some sort of mechanism to protect against it?
Even with the best science and technology that we have these days, it's going to take a minimum of 4 to 6 months. Not only is there the aspect that where we have to sort of sequence the genetic structure of the virus and then start to work out how that can be compensated for, there's also the prospect that you have to go through the process of developing sufficient levels of vaccines, doing trials on humans to make sure that it's not going to have adverse consequences, and then you've actually got to produce a large number of vaccines so that you can start to disseminate it. Because obviously, if you sort of start to feed it out only as it's being produced, it creates a concern amongst the community that why some people are getting it and others aren't. So you need a bit of a bulk of supply there to be able to launch a vaccination campaign.
In 1918, the infamous influenza epidemic killed millions of people around the world. Could something like that happen again this time?
Well, of course, back in 1918, we didn't even know what influenza was. We weren't sure that it was actually being spread by a virus. We didn't really know that much about it. So there was a lot of misinformation and a lot of fear and anxiety. Obviously, in today's society, we're much more advanced in terms of our scientific knowledge. And certainly we've got a lot better mechanisms to deal with this. The world is much better prepared to deal with these sort of circumstances. There is the chance that, nonetheless, if the virus turns out to be particularly deadly, and we're not seeing that at the moment, but if the virus does happen to mutate into some form that is particularly deadly, then obviously it can have very significant consequences for people all around the world.
We've seen lots of alarming media reports in the past week about how this is spreading and potentially how in this country, in the UK, it might be if you're in a confined space, you should be careful, blah, blah, blah. What would your advice be? How worried do you think people should be?
I think at this stage, particularly here in the UK, there's obviously no reason to panic, and people need to be aware of the circumstances, the fact that there is this new virus that's circulating, and they need to take basic precautions and perhaps increase the amount of times that they're doing things like hand washing and so forth, being a little bit more conscious to take basic precautions with sneezing and so forth, just to make sure that they're not spreading germs around us and limit the amount of exposure that they can get to it.
And just finally, how long do you think this particular virus will circulate for? Is there a normal time expectancy for when these things disappear?
Well, obviously, with seasonal variations, obviously in wintertime, influenza becomes more prominent. So there is the chance at the moment we may not see many more cases in the UK. There is that possibility. It is likely that the virus is going to continue to spread globally, though. And so what may happen over the coming months and potentially even over the next 1 to 2 years is that that virus will circulate the world. And there is always the risk that it could continue to change and mutate. And it can go either way. It could become more deadly or it become less so. And in which case, it could just become something like our regular seasonal influenza virus, where you end up with only a small proportion of people being affected by it and for which it's being fatal. And we just don't know at this point how that's going to develop.
That was Adam Cameron Scott from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. You can find out everything about you need or want to know about swine flu and keep up to date with it all at guardian.co.uk/science. Last week, a new exhibition opened at the Natural History Museum. It transports visitors from the grey streets of West London into a rainforest jungle full of life, including an iguana, giant centipedes and plenty of live butterflies. But the exhibition, called Butterfly Jungle, comes as The Guardian's Patrick Barkham wrote in last week's G2 that the extraordinary insects are declining in this country because of changes in the climate. Is there anything that can be done? Science Weekly went along to find out more about the beauty of the butterfly and spoke to Luke Brown, who manages the exhibition. He started by explaining one of the most striking parts of the display, the puparium.
We breed a lot of the butterflies in-house. They'll breed naturally in here. But we also bring in pupae every week, which are then glued onto canes and put into this puparium to hatch out. We can control the conditions in there far more intricately than we can in the house in general. And also, if there was any parasite problems come in with any of the pupae, it's a contained area that we can deal with that before they were let out into the main house. There's probably about 900 pupae in there at the moment. We will bring in 300 or 400 pupae every week. Even if we're breeding enough in-house to sustain the numbers that we need to bring in every week, so it helps to strengthen the bloodline of the species that we're breeding in here. We're probably hatching 50 or 60 a day from here at the moment. Within 3 or 4 weeks, it'll be breeding as well, naturally in the house. So it won't be very long before the number's up to over 1,000 butterflies.
The exhibition has tried to recreate the conditions of the forest. Inside, it's very hot, and Alex Munro, a botanist for the museum, describes some of the butterfly-friendly plants.
So what we've got here, we've got some really nice aromatic citrus. I think they're lemon plants, and the flowers of these smell really beautiful, and they produce a significant amount of nectar, so they're very attractive to the butterflies. But also the leaves are being eaten by caterpillars. So the caterpillar is here, is chewing on a citrus, on a lemon plant leaf. And when it's younger, it looks just like a bird dropping. And it does that by having a very wet sheen over its skin. It's a kind of dirty, browny green colour with lots of white streaks over it, just like a bird dropping. And it also has the outline, so it has a more bulbous head and it tapers down to a narrow end. But funnily enough, as they grow up, they completely change and they become a bright, a bright apple green with quite intricate brown and tan markings over it. Towards the head, the markings are made to look a bit like eyes. So a potential predator might think, oh, that might be a snake or the head of something bigger than me, and not go near it. But the general coloration is very similar to the leaf of the lemon plant as well.
But what about the decline of the butterfly? In this country, there aren't as many conditions for butterflies to thrive as there used to be. Luke explained the effect this has had on the population.
Over the last 20 years, there's been probably almost a 70% decline in UK species. There's five at the moment that are looking very sketchy and are on pretty severe problems. The dark brown fritillary is probably our most endangered species at the moment. I think we've lost five or six species over the last 50 years already. Although reintroduction programmes are in place for some of these species, we've still lost the original Britannica strain, basically. There's lots of reasons, really. Economic development is obviously an issue because we are losing habitat at an incredibly fast rate. Commercial pesticide overuse and things, none of this helps. On top of the fact we've had two really wet summers, which has, again, has hindered the recovery of some of these species that are struggling a lot anyway.
As well as this exhibition, the Natural History Museum has an amazing butterfly collection that dates back hundreds of years. The collection is about to be moved from storage back to a new building in the museum, enabling researchers to find out more about how important butterflies are. But can we still learn anything from the collection? Blanca Huertas.
Absolutely the most important tool for research, because all of the studies which has been conducted on any topic, taxonomy, systematics, genetic, even in now the function of a biodiversity crisis, I think we got more than 90% of the whole world's biodiversity represented in our collection. So if you need to write anything about butterflies or moths or beetles, you must come to here and get the locality data, taxonomy records. So it's very important for climate change, for example. We're still working. We got a lot of scientists. For example, to add into this our biodiversity inventory, I described last year one species and this year another one. So we're trying to keep on going to the field. We got hundreds, I promise you. I got boxes of things to describe.
There's two real reasons why we should be worried about losing butterflies. One, they're a brilliant barometer of what's happening in the general wildlife in general. Butterflies are one of the first things that will be affected, and so it's a big flashing warning light, basically. When there's a huge decline in butterflies, we know there's more problems to come. And on a personal level, I suppose, the other terrible thing about losing butterflies would be the world would be a far more dull, mundane place without them, because they're some of the most beautiful insects in the world. I think the most important thing is that we try and maintain the habitat that's left and keep it, and if we can recreate any more, then that's great. On a big scale, there is things with layerside farmland that is purposely there to help wildlife, but in areas where certain butterfly species are struggling, these layerside lands should be geared up more towards helping these individual species. And on an individual level, there's little bits that you can do at home. A square foot or a square metre of land isn't going to solve the problem, but there's over 15 million gardens in the UK, and if you put 15 million square foot together, you're over 300 acres of land immediately.
That was Luke Brown, and also you heard Alex Munro and Blanca Huertas from the Natural History Museum. Butterfly Jungle is open now and open every day until September the 27th. Before we go, back to our guest, Alice Roberts. Something that occurred to me while we were talking earlier was that if we found... You went to look right at the beginning at the cradle of human civilization, if I can call it that.
Don't call it civilization, is it? Civilization starts a lot later.
Okay, well, the cradle of the humans, then, in that case. our species. If that existed somewhere outside Somerset, I imagine that there'd be a stone circle around it and people would worship it. How do the locals in Africa treat that area? What are they aware of in terms of that area's significance, if anything? I mean, do they not treat it normally, abnormally at all?
No, I mean, they don't. I mean, they know that, scientists have found important fossils there, and they know that they are the sort of guardians of this place where... very early ancestors have been found, and I was taken to the find spot of of Richard Leakey's fossils by a couple of guides from the local village of Kibish. But when we got there, they said, this is the place. And I had to trust them because there's absolutely nothing there. You know, we're just in another bit of this strange lunar landscape. And there's nothing to mark it as being the spot where, you know, these incredibly ancient fossils were found. I mean, I felt very moved going there.
I was
going
to say, did you have a moment?
I did have a bit of a moment, yeah. I always found it quite difficult to get the piece to camera out because I was quite emotional about it. Because, you know, this has been I've always been fascinated by human evolution. And I think when you actually think about the full implication of it and you're going to somewhere where, you know, it may not be exactly where the first people of our species emerged, but you're probably getting pretty close to it, as close as you possibly can from the evidence that we have. And it's very exciting to visit locations where evidence is actually emerging. I visited quite a few archaeological sites where excavation was happening, so there was evidence actually coming out of the ground. And I also visited the Centre for Human Evolutionary Research in Leipzig, where Svante Paabo's group were sequencing the Neanderthal genome, so sort of hot on the heels of the Human Genome Project. We've got the Neanderthal Genome Project.
The Neanderthal Genome Project, which, as you say, the draft of which was published, was incredible for several reasons. One, that they managed to reconstruct it from essentially archaeological samples, but also what it told us about how similar Homo sapiens was to the Neanderthal species as well.
I think we kind of know that looking at their skeletons as well, though. I mean, their skulls look quite different, I would say, but I reckon I could put an arm bone, a humerus, in a medical student exam and they wouldn't notice. But then, having said that, I think I could probably put a chimpanzee arm bone in a medical student exam and they wouldn't notice the difference either.
Well, let's leave it there on the worrying thought that our medical students around the country can't tell the difference between chimpanzees and humans. Alice, thank you so much for that. Also, and remember that Alice's programme starts on Sunday, May the 10th, The Incredible Human Journey. Thanks also to James Randerson for his erudite words in the News Jam. Quick comment from the blog this week, HMD1 wrote to say, could you tell David Eagleman that summa cum laude is Latin, not Greek? If he's going to be pretentious, he could at least be accurate. I think that's a bit harsh. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.